You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Turn it off.
Well, I did.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249 and International Association of Firefighters Local 42. United Auto Workers Local 249 members, building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. And this show is brought to you by the Greater Kansas City Firefighters IAFF Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, International Association of Firefighters, representing fire, EMS, and public safety professionals, serving you since 1918. Local 42 advocates continuously for the public good, and we depend on you to help us defend the rights of our diverse membership of men and women. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Carl Icahn is an old foe in Kansas City, but he's back in national news. As an investigation of his conflict of interest, we'll talk to former machinist union leaders Herb Johnson and Keith Nelson about how Carl destroyed TWA. Then, we interview an expert from the Economic Policy Institute about how state legislatures are preempting cities from passing pro-worker laws. In the news, labor leaders respond to Trump's reversal of DACA, and public approval of unions now at 61%. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo. And now for the news.
This is the news from our site, September 7, 2017. The Gallup poll released August 30th shows that the popularity of unions is on the rise. Gallup has been measuring people's approval of unions since 1936, when it was 72%. It peaked in the 1950s and has gone up and down since, mostly down. The lowest point was 48% in 2009. In the new poll, 61% of adults said they approve of labor unions. This is the highest since 2003, when 65% approved, and up 5% just since last year. 81% of Democrats approved of unions this year, significantly higher than the 42% of Republicans who approve. Interestingly, approval by Republicans has grown 10 points since last year. Independents come in at 61% approval rate. Another question asked whether people wanted unions to have more, the same, or less influence. 39% said more, 28% said less, and 30% said the same. That bodes well for the Missouri right to work fight, since the right to work legislation would decrease the influence of unions by shrinking their membership. Still, Americans remain more pessimistic than optimistic about the union's future. 46% say they think unions will become weaker than they are today, while 27% said they will be the same, and 22% say stronger.
AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka announced Tuesday decision by Trump administration to end deferred action program for immigrants brought here as children with legal status. Currently, about 800,000 young people qualified for DACA, which gives them peace of mind, and they won't be deported any work permit. Trump's white supremacist attorney general announced the change, stating DACA would end in 6 months unless Congress passes a law giving legal status to the so-called Dreamers. Trump said, quote, "This direct attack on union members and union values only strengthen our resolve to overcome racial divisions and demand changes to a system rigged to benefit the wealthiest and corporations. The eyes of history are upon us. The labor movement will stand with these brave young workers and fight for legislation so that the contributions they make are celebrated rather than assaulted. We will push for pathways to citizenship and continue to oppose enforcement policies that discriminate and generate fear in our workplaces and communities. We will not give up the struggle until all working people have the rights on the jobs, regardless of where they are born," he said. Teachers Union President Randy Weingartner said that Trump is upending the lives and the dreamers of more than 850,000 young people, and for what? To stroke resentment and fear.
A Texas judge has permanently killed the overtime pay change, which would have given 12.5 million workers access to overtime. The rule was promulgated under President Barack Obama's, but stopped by a Texas federal judge named Amos Mazant. He decided last week to make his injunction permanent, thus killing it for good. It's doubtful that the Trump Department of Labor will try to revive it. This case is a reminder that right-wing attorneys general around the country are succeeding over and over in stopping federal regulations which benefit the poor, workers, and immigrants, as well as the environment. Trump's DACA decision was in part influenced by the threat of these same state attorneys general to sue. PAI reports that in the overtime case, 21 states sued, led by Nevada's Alan Laxalt, with business backers led by the Chamber of Commerce. Virtually all cases are filed in Texas federal courts, where judges are particularly right-wing. Had the overtime rule stayed in effect, many exempt employees who earn up to $47,476 yearly would have gained access to overtime pay. The law mandates time and a half pay for all workers worked over all hours worked over 40 per week. The current and 12-year-old mandated overtime pay limit is $23,660. A prior Economic Policy Institute analysis reported 6.4 million working women were eligible for Obama's overtime pay expansion, along with 1.5 million African Americans, 2 million Hispanics, and 4.5 million millennials. Almost 40% of farm workers would have benefited. So would 3 out of every 8 leisure and hospitality workers and 1/3 of construction workers. These are people typically called managers, but who do not truly meet the test for exemption.
Remember the case of the two KCK teens, a boy and a girl, who both got jobs a year ago at Pizza Studio in the Legends? When she found out she was being paid 25 cents less an hour than he, she called the manager to ask why, and both were fired. This was local news, and it became national news, and the pair went to the Democratic National Convention, invited by Hillary Clinton to speak. Well, this week, after over a year, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filed suit in federal court in Kansas City, Kansas, against the parent company, which is called PS Holding LLC, even though it no longer owns the restaurant in KCK. The suit charges the company with violating the 1963 Equal Pay Act, which makes it illegal to pay men and women differently for the same job, simply because of their gender. It also makes it illegal to retaliate for complaining about it. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Molly Madden, Lon Swearingen, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
This is Jacob White. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum, and today we're speaking
Herb Johnson and Keith Nelson. They were in the leadership of IAM Local 1650 here in Kansas City, and they battled Carl Icahn back in the 90s. And, you know, before we went on, we were sort of joking about how I hadn't even been born when a lot of this had happened, or I was just a little baby. But a lot of people say that the internet and social media and being able to see things as they're happening has sort of changed the way that we people respond to injustices like this. How did you guys, as the union leadership, as workers, how were you sort of finding out about what Carl was doing? Was he like, was trying to keep it out of the papers? Do you know what I mean? Like, how would you find it? Was it mostly word of mouth?
Are you talking about early on, or?
Yeah, or just like when he would sell roots, or when he sold the London hub, things like that. Would that be in the papers?
Well, we were represented on the board of directors.
Okay.
You know, because we had one of these ESOPs, another one of these phony things there that you get an opportunity to participate in when the companies are about gone out of existence. And so to save your employment, you do these kind of things. And so we had an ESOP, and so we had board membership, and so we knew everything that was going on through our organization. The machinists and the pilots, the flight attendants, all had the same kind of information. That's how we would find out. That's how we would find out, and then we would communicate that, and we battled as a result of that.
Our international and our district also had their finger on the pulse.
Yes.
While they're in negotiations, they would find out these things. And, of course, we did our very best here in Kansas City to make sure that the news media knew about that, which would help us in rallying our people and getting solidarity behind our goal to keep him out.
Yeah, and beyond what you were finding out, you know, going on to this responding, what were some of the ways that you guys fought back practically as a union against the things that Icahn was doing?
Let me give credit to Herb. Herb, when he was elected president, I was elected vice president, we got together and we put together a program to wake up the membership, basically. And Herb, great order. We had some terrific meetings, and when we normally would have a tenth of our union hall filled, all of a sudden, because of the threat that what was going on and the fantastic job Herb did of rallying the people, we would fill those union halls. We put together a system to where we trained a lot of our union stewards. We had a communication system that would go from a message that Herb would put out or myself would put out, and it would go down five steps to where everybody, we made sure everybody was covered. Much like, what do they call, a phone tree or whatever. Everybody was responsible for somebody. And so in a minute's notice, we could have the people rallied if we need to. And there was some work actions that took place on the property.
Yeah, Herb, do you want to go into some more detail on this?
Well, it'd be real handy today if we had the iPhone.
Yeah.
But it was today it's referred to in labor studies as the inside game. And that's what it was. We created a mechanism to communicate any message we want to thousands of people in a very short period of time. I'm talking about just a couple of hours. Normally that would take you days to do. We would be able to do that in just a couple of hours through the network that he's just now talking about, that went from one hand to this hand to that hand, and everybody knew what this message was. And a lot of times this message was nothing but, it's an A day. The whole thing was to organize militancy and aggressiveness in that body of people, and believe you me, we built a fist. I can tell you that I could have evacuated that building any time, and did on a number of occasions, very quickly. We would all be outside the building. Now, that can't happen and keep airplanes on schedule over here at this terminal or anywhere else. And although we were an overhaul base and not as immediate as a hub would be, what we were doing in a hub would really be devastating. But us being in the maintenance operation, they still had to have us supplying those airplanes for them to make schedules. You all of a sudden shut down and nothing's happening, and then all of a sudden everything is happening and it's back off and it's on and it's this, that, and another. Where you have, well, I used to say, and it's true, information with communication is power, the ultimate power. We're seeing it play out today in the country, as a matter of fact. It's a new phenomena, but in that world. But in any case, a lot of this we got from a lot of the education and training we got right here from Beauty and other training that we had had at our international headquarters. But we actually created our own program. And we had it set up in, we didn't have slides, we had over, what did you call those, film that we used to use before, overhead.
PowerPoint.
Before we even had that technology. Later we did get that technology, and so we would teach that in school at our training that we would conduct at the local. But we had that communication system. That was a tool we used at the heart and center of most everything, because we were able to use that to as I said, build a militaristic, aggressive membership out of a real sleepy bunch of souls. I mean, you had to really wake them up and let them realize here that there's somebody taking your bacon and we're going to stop them. And I do remember one meeting in particular where there was 700 or 800 people in that building. I had each one of them get up one at a time across that room until we got to 47. I said, now stand up. 47. Turn around and look at the audience. That's how many people we got fired for this action by this individual we're talking about right now. That's how many people, by the way, that signed that charter over on that wall in 1945 that created this local. We're not going to tolerate this. We're not going to crawl on our bellies here and take this anymore. And so, I mean, their fire was lit. We had numerous of those kinds of meetings and made them vote on, remember the plan?
Yeah, vote on a plan.
We had a plan of attack.
Another thing that we did,
we had to have a buy-in from them. So after we would present this plan to these people at that meeting, then it would have a vote to make sure you and everybody else realize you're part of this right here. Now, if we elect to do this, fine, we're all going to vote for it right here, and you've got to have a buy-in to be part of it. We're coming to you for help and assistance. And so it was a very serious situation.
Another thing that we did that was real effective, though, is we had various organized rallies that we did. We would fall out in front of the overhaul base prior to going into work. We'd issue press releases that we were having this, and our people would fall out prior to going to work. So they were fired up all the time. I remember us borrowing, I think it was from Building Trades, the big red rat suit.
Yeah.
That we had a rally out in front, and we was demonizing somebody when we were doing it just to get the people rallied behind us. One of my other things that turned out to be kind of cute is we staged along the route going in to the overhaul base, similar to Bermichet signs, only I went over to Jackson Plumbing in their salvage yard, and I bought about 10 toilet seats. And so then we'd put a sign in each one of these, employees' wages in the toilet, employees' benefits. And the last one, I had a half of a mannequin that we put in upside down in there, you know, employees in the toilet. So you'd drive through there and see that. Well, that was wonderful inspiration for our people, but we also had the news media out there, and showed it to our entire community, so they knew the fight that was going on.
Yeah.
And as Herb said, thank goodness for this radio station here, because we was able to rally our folks even here. We had a number of our people calling in, and at that time they were making contributions to listen to the program because they wanted to hear what was going on.
Oh yeah, it was. This was one of the most hilarious things I ever saw in my life. I mean, everybody had to enter that facility, whether they were hourly or not hourly. Everybody, engineer, everybody had to enter that facility the same place, so they all had to drive by this. And here they get there in the morning, and he's got these toilets out there lined up down that road. I'm telling you, it was, and of course, they were just livid.
Yeah, and what happened too, though, then the plant maintenance guy gave instructions to our guys, which was a machinist guy, go out there and pick up them toilets and get them off of the roadway coming in. And so they did, but they hid them. And whenever we'd call, we knew that the president was coming into town, so we'd put one on the elevator going up to the vice president's office. And so he got to step in, and there's one of those toilets with a sign in it. So we did that a few times. Finally, the supervisor of plant maintenance made him put them all in a dumpster, and he sat out there and watched as it took a backhoe and crushed all those toilets up.
Then one time, they had a promotional program called Horizons.
Oh, you can't tell this story, Herb. You got to leave that
one. We can always delete it.
Yeah, and so we went out there and swedged this big, great big
sign. Let's go.
It was like
ideas on the horizon. So on one of those big blue tarps,
yeah,
we had painted a half of a globe, and coming up behind the globe was a hand with a finger
up your horizon.
And we borrowed TWA's cable swedges that we used on aircraft to cable swedge that to the overpass on I-29, so when the folks came in under the entrance, it'd be up underneath.
There's no way to avoid it.
And this was one of those deals that they were trying to help us out. You know, you give us some ideas, and we're going to give you a shotgun or something like that. You
and
know,
it was, this was like
promotional deals that was like hokey to try to put a wedge between the management and the union leadership.
It was like a 7/8 cable for landing gear. So they didn't have anything to cut it. I mean, they took them all day to get this down when they sent maintenance over there to get it down. And I think it was one of those days when we had the entry of these important people that would come to town. We had blinkers and those signs and everything up down on the guard gate. On the top of the entering gate up there was this sign, Taco John's opening soon. And they were, I mean, they had to bring, you know, the icon type people through that kind of a arrangement that we're talking about. So it was funny, and it was fun, but it was done intentionally for a purpose. He was our communications person, as you know, and was always doing the press releases and setting up press conferences and that sort of thing. And he's also our artist. He drew almost all these.
Well,
anything that was drawn.
Don't be telling who did that stuff.
Anything that was drawn had to be done neat. And I can't draw anything neat. Matter of fact, I can't really do anything. He is the guy that produced, put all anything we did together so it was legible, understandable, and it made sense. All I did was talk about it. It was quite a battle. And looking back on it, it was a lot of fun in doing it. I wish it could have turned out even better than it did. At least we did the one thing I've told the members that we were there for. The only reason the union exists. I remember telling a guy this right out of the grocery store, right out here, who's giving me a little difficulty. I said, you keep in mind, the number one thing we got to do is to keep your job. We don't have any other reason to exist.
And we did extend the life of TWA.
Keep your job, too. And we did that.
Yeah.
And people out on the system did their part, too. At stations, for instance, all they got to do is screw something up, and an airplane doesn't make its, you know, it can't depart on time if it leaves at all. We did a lot of stuff. We shipped parts all over the country. They didn't know where. They didn't know. They even lost an aircraft tail one time. You recall that? No, it was a rudder. I believe it was a rudder. It was a big air. It was either a rudder or it might have been the fin. Anyway, it got sent another place in the country, so this airplane didn't have that part. It was several days before they could truck it back. And we had Teamsters that were driving our trucks, our over-the-road trucks, so we had the cooperation of them as well.
So we had a lot of little things. I brought in a button here that says it's working. What's that mean, you know? But it really annoyed management. And we had stickers of all types, and there probably wasn't a bathroom toilet wall that didn't have some kind of a sticker, an anti-icon sticker or some kind on it. It really annoyed management to do this. We've given you way more. You got to cut out a lot of stuff.
Well, that's all right. We've Keith brought in a poster from the Heartland Labor Forum, March 1st, 9 to 10 on KKFI, 365 days of the Eastern Strike. And I think we decided it was one of the first episodes of Heartland Labor Forum, if not the first, in 1990. And this is just one of the flyers and buttons that Keith brought in. So I think on social media, on Facebook, we might try to post some of the stuff that you brought in because it's really fun to look at. You know, part of radio is that you can't really see what we're looking at in here. But I just want to thank you guys so much for coming in and for sharing these hilarious stories with us and showing, you know, you can talk back and still have a good time doing it. So
yeah, and Jacob, we even do better over a bottle of beer if you want to buy us a beer.
Well, I've got one in my bag, but I don't know if that's enough for the three of us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks really so much for coming in, and everyone, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed it.
The 2017 Crossroads Music Fest is partnering with Midwest Music Foundation, the University of Kansas, and the Community Health Council of Wyandotte County to present a free musicians' healthcare clinic, offering information, screenings, wellness programs, opportunities to discuss health conditions and concerns, and arrange follow-up opportunities. Musicians, stop by and take a minute for yourself. It's free. September 9th at the Living Room Theater, 1818 McGee, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. More information is available at cmfkc.com.
After the Harvest, a nonprofit volunteer hunger relief organization, is looking for volunteers to help pick fruits and vegetables to feed people in need. Call 816-921-1903 or go to our website, aftertheharvestkc.org, for more information. This message, a public service of 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. Joining us on the phone is Marnie Von Wilbert, Associate Labor Counsel for the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington, D.C. Marnie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So we're going to be talking with Marnie about state preemption laws. Can you tell us a little bit more about what preemption actually means?
Yes. So preemption is a tool used by a higher level of government to supersede an ordinance made by a lower level of government. So the federal government can preempt the state governments from doing things, and state governments can preempt their county and city level governments from enacting rules or ordinances. And so what we are seeing a lot at EPI is we are focusing on the labor and employment preemption laws that states have passed recently in the past 10, 15 years to prevent their cities and county governments from raising local labor standards.
And can you tell us why we're seeing this, you said in the past 10 or 15 years, why are we seeing an increase in these state preemption laws to counteract some workers' initiatives on the municipal level?
Yeah, great question. You know, usually preemption historically had been used for good. Historically, preemption meant that no city or locality could go below a certain floor of workers and labor's rights. Mm-hmm. So the minimum wage was just that, the minimum. No one could go below that, or paid sick days that the state required every employer to offer. No one could offer less than that, sure, or fewer paid sick days than that. But now, especially since around 2013, a very conservative lobbying group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC for short, mm-hmm, has really started pushing the use of preemption as the opposite, to prevent local governments from going above the state standard. And a lot of the reason this has been happening is because the federal government and state governments have not been acting on labor and employment standards. We haven't seen the federal minimum wage increase since 2009. Currently, nationwide, the Family Medical Leave Act only provides for unpaid leave. There's no fair scheduling statutes going out nationwide, although, you know, the Democrats in Congress are trying to push those. And so in the absence of this federal and state government action, localities have been trying to raise their own working standards for their workers. And so we saw, you know, in the early 2000s, only a handful of cities and counties had raised their own minimum wages. But by 2017, over 40 counties across the country have tried to do this. And so as local governments have tried to take up the call to raise labor standards, that's when we see conservative lobbyist groups going to the state governments and trying to reverse them or bring them back down.
And it seems like like it would be sort of a convoluted process, all these municipalities going, you know, across the nation bit by bit doing this, you know, raising minimum wage here and doing this there. Is it easier? When I think of workers groups and trying to raise the standards of workers in their areas, is it easier for workers to do this on a municipal by municipal level, or is it easier to do it on a state level? Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, it would be easier to be able to petition your local government than a state government, because oftentimes the state government is very far away from where you might live.
Sure.
So you're getting to the capital is one thing. But the other thing is people are interested in working through their local governments to address the working conditions in their cities, which may be very different than cities in a different part of the state. And
sure.
So what folks are doing, such as the Fight for 15 movement and, you know, unions, are going to their local government and saying, hey, we're not able to live on $7.25 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage. We need to raise it, or we have, you know, these paid sick leave days need to come into our town because we're realizing that all of our workers are suffering by having to choose between a paycheck or going to work sick. And so they're doing what the democratic process asked them to do in our country. They petition their local representatives, they go to their city council meetings, they have hearings, they have petitions signed, and then they get the local ordinance passed. But what ALEC is pushing is then going above and around them by having state representatives who do not represent the cities that these folks work in.
Hmm.
So what you saw in, you know, St. Louis was somebody from outside the area of St. Louis, a state legislator, dropped a bill in the state government and said, listen, we're going to preempt any locality from raising their own minimum wage.
Oh, wow.
And so it's very difficult for folks in the cities to go to a district that doesn't represent them.
Sure.
And go to a state legislator that does not represent them and ask, why are you doing this to roll back our labor standards?
Sure.
So it's very anti-democratic in that way.
And speaking of anti-democratic, when you mentioned ALEC, can you tell us just a little bit about what ALEC is, kind of how it operates, who's involved? Are these, as Bernie Sanders used to say, the millionaires and the billionaires of the world, of the nation, getting together to fight workers' rights? Who are these people and how do they operate?
Yes. So ALEC is a very obscure organization, and it's hard to find exactly who their funders are, but the Koch brothers are very big backers of ALEC, and a lot of their corporate partners are big backers of ALEC.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2013, ALEC reintroduced their model legislation called the Living Wage Mandate Preemption Act. And when they put that out and started lobbying on that, that's when really you saw a huge spike in states across the country start to enact these preemption laws, not just in minimum wage, but also in paid leave, in fair scheduling, in prevailing wage, in preemption, product labor agreements, preventing their cities and localities from raising any of these standards. And so ALEC is definitely a corporate-backed lobbying group, pro-business lobbying group that really doesn't want to see state governments and city governments raising worker standards.
Okay.
And one of the biggest arguments that ALEC uses in trying to push this legislation is that, well, we don't want a patchwork of local regulations all throughout the state. We shouldn't have different paid leave laws or different fair scheduling laws. It should be uniform.
I see.
Well, that ends when they try and push local right-to-work ordinances. So ALEC also has a local right-to-work ordinance model bill that it pushed out and tried to push into Kentucky and won. And so they are all for a patchwork argument when it lowers workers' rights, but want similar standards when people trying to raise them.
In addition to the minimum wage, can you tell us where ALEC has been successful in pushing these other sort of agendas in other states?
Yes. So we've seen fair scheduling laws have been preempted in many states. So far, you know, we've got a dozen in the last year and a half that have been enacted in Arkansas, Georgia, Iowa, Tennessee, Alabama, a lot of the southern states.
Oh, wow.
Same thing with prevailing wage and product labor agreements. You know, prevailing wage is when a city government is handing out its city contracts. They require a certain wage to be paid on those projects. And that's very important, because if you do not have a prevailing wage requirement, then contractors will then just lower wages as a way to try and be more competitive on bids, as opposed to having other innovations, such as being more productive or different material costs. So instead of putting the contract cost in the back of workers in their cities, a lot of cities say, no, you have to pay a prevailing wage. Well, we're seeing a lot of states preempt their cities from acquiring that with their own city money. So Florida, Iowa, Kentucky, Missouri, Wisconsin, Alabama, they've all passed prevailing wage preemption laws since 2016. So that's another problem. And then the paid leave preemption is on the rise, too. So localities are trying to offer their workers the right to earn paid leave.
Oh, wow.
Every day they go to work, they should bank up the right to take a sick day. But what we saw in 2011 was Wisconsin state legislature passed a preemption law to repeal Milwaukee's paid sick leave ordinance, even though the voters in Milwaukee had approved that ordinance with a 69% support in their ballot initiative.
Oh, wow.
So now no more paid sick leave standards in Milwaukee anymore.
So how long did the workers in Milwaukee enjoy that? I couldn't imagine having something like that. You know, for example, I work at Ford Motor Company, so I have a lot of these sort of protections under the collective bargaining agreement with the UAW. But I couldn't imagine being in a position where you're just so incredibly vulnerable, and then you finally get this measure of security, and then to have it taken away from you. How long did the workers there enjoy it? What was the reaction to having it taken away?
You know, the ballot initiative was passed in 2008, and in 2011 is when the legislature took it away. So I'm not sure exactly when the ballot initiative went into effect.
Sure.
I don't have that knowledge with me. But,
sure.
You know, the problem, like you said, is imagine having planned family leave, for example, and you plan to have a child because you now know that you have the right to earn family time away from work, and then all of a sudden that's taken away. Well, you're still having the child or adopting a child, but now you have to figure out how to scramble, how to take care of that child without losing your job.
And have we seen that before, where citizens in a municipality or at a state level or at a lower level were able to secure benefits and then to have them taken away? I know that, you know, there are ALEC and the other organizations that are working at a state level to do that, but do we actually have an example where they have enjoyed a benefit for a certain period of time and then had it taken away?
Yes. So what we've seen, other than what happened in Milwaukee, is a lot of minimum wage increases have been taken away. And so what we saw in St. Louis, of course, was at the end of August, workers who were receiving $10 an hour because of the city's ordinance, the minimum wage is now back down to $7.70. Same thing with Kansas City.
Wow.
There are other localities that were prevented from even trying to raise standards for their workers.
Wow.
And so what you saw in Ohio was Cleveland had gotten all ready to place a ballot initiative and for their local city government to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2021. But the state legislature got word of it, and in 2016, Governor Kasich signed a preemption law blocking the city's ability to even put the question to their residents on a voter initiative. So it's a big problem.
Unbelievable. So are they actually being sued by, like, say, retailers associations or restaurant associations? I mean, people who would be opposed to increasing minimum wages or increasing labor standards for workers? Is that what's happening? Is that the process?
Well, no, not all the time. I mean, there was a lawsuit in St. Louis which prevented the minimum wage from being increased until earlier this year, and it was a group of employers who sued, saying that localities should not be able to raise minimum wage. And the city of St. Louis won that case. They litigated for 2 years, and the Missouri Supreme Court said, no, there's nothing in the state law or constitution that prevents this from happening. But just as they won that case, the state legislature then in 2017 amended their preemption law and said, okay, well, we're just going to make so that you cannot do it. And they did, and that's why everyone lost their raises.
Wow. So In a situation like this, in an environment like this, where working people, and I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, what union density is nationwide or what it is in Missouri compared to other states, but with union density, members belonging to a labor union or being protected by a collective bargaining agreement, it's historically so low since, you know, the high in 1955 or whatever it was. How can working people, either through their unions or through whatever association, how can they even fight back against this? So what's the plan for organized labor? What should working people do? What can working people in Kansas City do, for example, to fight back against these attacks?
Yeah, well, the ultimate goal is to repeal these state laws, which, you know, is a political fight. And So doing everything that workers can do to join together to have their voice heard is exactly what we have to keep doing. So increasing union membership rates and strengthening collective bargaining rights, you know, the Fight for 15 movement has been great because it's really taken the fight out into the street, and so that people understand what this is about. You know, I was talking to a colleague the other day and said, I don't know if I ever would have understood what preemption was until what happened in St. Louis, when you saw people losing their hard-fought pay raises.
Right.
And so by getting out and making this an issue that the public has to be aware of, workers really can have that power to do so. But you're right, it's difficult.
Well, Marnie, I appreciate it. I think that that's just about all the time that we have for today. Is there anything else that are there other resources that our listeners can go to find out more about what preemption means, who's behind it, and what they can do about it? Is there any more information online?
Yes. If you go to the Economic Policy website, our Economic Policy Institute's website, we have a whole section on preemption, links to other reports and documents, and we're tracking it to see what's going on and how many state governments are really taking away workers' rights. So we will keep watch, and we're happy to hear from folks if they write to us.
Thank you so much, Marnie. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Come on, kids! Gather round! Listen up! The magic clap! Forever, this is the last kiss. Martin Navigator Coretta. It's like a paparazzi picture when I flash my Beretta. I got scars on my back, the truth on my tongue. I had the money in my hand when that alarm got wrong. We wanna refight freedom from our lungs to homeland security. We are the bomb. This here the meeting for the overthrow. Waiting on the concrete coast to grow. Doing lies that ain't quotable. Coming up all that dough you owe. You ain't supposed to know, it's supposable. We are not disposable. Muscle and kick, we got blow to blow. To the folks at prison, there'll be no decision. We make the motor move, they show for driven. Right now we can't shine right like a broken prism. I figured out the 14th is a broke commitment. Good evening, tonight we bring to you worn out streets that I sing to you. 45 shells that I dance to the beats. Stomach so loud that I cancel the speech. Checks that vanish if you blink an eye. Race getting locked in the clink of an eye. Salary cap on a birth certificate. Notarized eyes at first certificate. Morning prayers for the car to start. A man in a whiskey and a heart to heart. Hope in a track suit to flash and run. While agony chasing with a battling gun. Poetry shouted from the squeal on the bus brakes. Hands in the air, try to feel for an escape. Flash in my eyes like candid snaps. When we slap back, it's a magic clap.
2017 Crossroads Music Fest is partnering with Midwest Music Foundation, the University of Kansas, and the Community Health Council of Wyandotte County to present a free musicians' healthcare clinic, offering information, screenings, wellness programs, opportunities to discuss health conditions and concerns, and arrange follow-up opportunities. Musicians, stop by and take a minute for yourself. It's free. September 9th at the Living Room Theater, 1818 McGee, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. More information is available at cmfkc.com.
Bucky Hawker's Remember Verdun. Stay tuned for Safety First.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety. To say that they lie, I'm saying we just come to work here, we don't come to die.
Hello, This is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, weeks after employee died, Blue Springs firm cited again for violating safety rules from the August 19th Kansas City Star. Teresa O'Hare raged last December 2016 at the owner of the Blue Springs Plumbing Company that employed her son, DJ. Relatives held her back from Aero Plumbing LLC owner Ricky Smith as firefighters worked for hours to retrieve the body of 33-year-old Donald J. Meyer from the bottom of a 12-foot trench that lacked the required shoring to prevent cave-ins. She blamed Smith for what happened that day in Belton, but as months passed, she found herself seething less as she focused on raising her widower son's now 9-year-old boy, Ashton, at their home in Oak Grove. Then, the week of August 19th, anger rose in her again when she learned that Aero Plumbing had been fined more than $700,000 for workplace safety violations, not just for Meyer's death, but also for allegedly failing to take steps to prevent other employees from dying in the same way her son did, suffocating beneath tons of loose soil, based on an OSHA inspection the month following Meyer's death. Aero's penalty is the second largest meted out nationwide by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration so far this year against a single employer for allegedly violating workplace safety rules. The only one larger, $1.47 million, was levied against a company in Massachusetts where two employees died also in an unshored trench. Next, OSHA covers up workplace fatalities. From the confined space at jordanbarab.com/confined space for August 25th. In August, OSHA gained new political leadership under Deputy Assistant Secretary Lauren Sweet. And now we're seeing the first impact of the Trump-Acosta-Sweet regime at OSHA, a brazen attempt to hide from the American public the extent of workplace fatalities in this country. On August 25th, OSHA removed from its website a running list of workers killed on the job. That list had been preface with a statement, OSHA's mission is to prevent workplace injuries, illness, and death. This listing of names was added to the OSHA webpage in 2010. The purpose of adding names and circumstances was to impress people with the tragedy that workers and their families face every day. Without information like this, fatality statistics are just raw, sterile numbers. Instead of the list of workers killed, a different list now appears on OSHA's data webpage, listing only those fatalities that have received citations and removing the names of those killed. Replacing the list of fatalities on the homepage is a new feature, OSHA working with employers. So OSHA has essentially replaced the list of workers killed on the job, mostly due to violations of OSHA standards, with a list of employers who are allegedly doing the right thing. And just to make sure any pretense of caring about workers is gone from the homepage, the new leadership has also removed the video on how to file a complaint. These actions come on top of the elimination of OSHA press releases for all but a few of the most egregious cases. The Chamber of Commerce and other industry associations have long opposed the OSHA press releases and any listing of workers killed on the job because they claim it falsely implies that employers were to blame. Despite OSHA's actions, the Confined Space newsletter will continue to publish the weekly toll, a partial list of workplace fatalities that can be found on the web. Finally, Trump's Interior Department moves to stop mountaintop removal public health study. From Ken Ward Jr. at www.wvgazettemail.com for August 21st. Trump administration officials have told the National Academy of Sciences to halt a review of the increased public health risk faced by Appalachian residents who live near mountaintop removal coal mining sites. Word of the U.S. Department of Interior's order was disclosed by the academies just hours before the scientific panel conducting the study was scheduled to hear from coal field residents at a public meeting in Hazard, Kentucky. Academy spokesman William Kearney said in a statement that the Office of Surface Mining told the academies in a letter on August 18th to cease all work on the mountaintop removal study. The letter indicated the Interior had begun an agency-wide review of grants and cooperative agreements in excess of $100,000. The National Academies believes this to be an important study, and we stand ready to resume it as soon as the Department of Interior review is complete, the statement from Kearney said. Last year, OSM committed to providing more than $1 million for the study in response to growing pressure from citizen groups and requests from the State Bureau of Public Health in understanding studies by experts at West Virginia University that found increased risk of birth defects, cancer, and other illnesses and premature death among residents living near mountaintop removal sites. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Kansas City Progressive Conference, Advocacy and Action, this Saturday, September 9th, 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Some of the topics they're covering are education advocacy, accessible housing, direct democracy. Speakers include Dr. Lawrence Marsh, Jason Kander, and Darren McGee. To register, go to Eventbrite and look for Kansas City Progressive Conference, or check out our calendar on our webpage. The Teamsters are collecting donations for victims of Hurricane Harvey. This Saturday morning at the Teamsters Hall, 4501 Cleaver Boulevard. Also, there's going to be a protest at 9 a.m. Protesting the removal of Teamster pensions. And again, that's Saturday, September 9th, 9 a.m. at 4501 Cleaver Boulevard. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting will be this coming Tuesday. That's a change of date from last Tuesday, 6:30 p.m., September 12th, All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut. Missouri Immigrant and Refugee Advocates Art Show, Looking Among Cross-Cultural Connections. The opening is, it's going to be from September 15th to October 15th. The opening reception is September 14th, 6 to 8 p.m. This is at the new offices of Jewish Vocational Services. To RSVP for the reception, go to jvskc.org. And the AFL-CIO Organizing Institute is teaching internal and external organizing November 3rd through 5th, 2017 in Boston. And for more information on that, go to aflcio.org/O! To see all this and listen to past shows and see our upcoming calendar, go to heartlandlaborforum.org. Next week, the Heartland Labor Forum is going to cover the Right to Work Signature Campaign and Greitens Dark Money. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.